Let's Talk Development, Season 3, Episode 5.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this podcast by IGC and CDPR, Let's Talk Development. We're going to focus on a question: how do we deliver growth in an uncertain world? And I'm really, really happy, first of all, to be hosting this. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Shah Rukhwani, or Shah. I am the Senior Country Manager for Zambia at the International Growth Center, where I also coordinate some of our data and AI work. But enough about me. We're joined by Roberta, I'm going to pronounce it properly, Roberta Ghati, who is the Chief Economist of Middle East, North Africa, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Really interesting, complex, dynamic region for the World Bank. Has been at the World Bank for a long time, but not too long. Studied at Bocconi, did her PhD in economics from Harvard, has taught at Georgetown, has published widely on public economics and economic growth questions. So this is the right person for the right question. So today we're going to have a very casual conversation about economic growth, big headwinds in economic growth. What should people be talking about, thinking about, policymakers, grad students, whoever is interested in this question? Welcome, Roberta.
Well, Shah Rukh, it's great to be here, and especially it's great to be here in Lahore. It's my first time in this beautiful city and in Pakistan, so awesome. It's all lovely. And you wanted to have a casual conversation about growth. You know what you made me think of?
What?
You made me think of something that I think Bob Lucas, a Nobel laureate from Chicago, said: once you start thinking about growth, it's hard to think about anything else.
Yeah.
So I don't know how casual.
But all economists have a quote about their specific field. It's like, when you start thinking about behavior stuff, you can't think about anything else. If you start thinking about environmental economics.
But I think this is even true. I think you can Google check it.
I completely believe you. And
thank you.
I think the cool thing about growth is that almost everything we care about often is correlated very strongly with growth. So from development outcomes, from health, education,
absolutely,
lots of stuff. Causality is hard to establish, but I think if we care about this, we care about it, and how do we deliver on growth. So maybe just kick us off, mm-hmm, and kick off for your first visit to Lahore. I'm sure there'll be many more. What are the big things we need to think about at economic growth right now in this moment? And we want to think about the uncertainty around the world, whether it's trade or climate shocks.
Well, there are many moving parts that we need to think about growth today. So we're witnessing globally a growth slowdown. In practice, as also in terms of potential growth, trade is slowing down. Mm. We see increased fragility. And I think that's particularly the case for the region that I follow more closely. There's been a significant increase in debt, which has been further boosted by the pandemic and the spending that was necessary around it. And there are these long-term trends that are fundamental to sustainable growth in the future. And I'm thinking about climate change. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean to put a wet blanket on the conversation, but there are quite a lot of headwinds. And I think you put your finger on the wound. Is that the expression in English?
This is my third language. I have
completely. Oh, okay. So it's my third one too.
We're both in the same boat.
Awesome.
Here.
Awesome. Which one is your first?
So I spoke Kosher, okay, which is a regional language in the north of the country, and then Urdu, sort of the lingua franca, and then English.
Okay. So for me, it's Italian, then French, which I started when
buongiorno. That's
then
French.
Bonjour when I was 11, and then finally English, which I started to learn when I was 20.
Wow.
Yesterday.
Oh, yeah, a year ago.
A year ago.
Okay. So we both are completely lost
absolutely
on this. So apologies to the audience.
Absolutely. But so I think you put your finger on the wound, if that's the expression, when you talked about uncertainty. I think this is a highly uncertain time. We even see it in the indicators. There's plenty out there. Some of them are just, you know, sort of word searches in the press. But uncertainty has shot up. And a lot of this uncertainty is driven at the moment by trade policy uncertainty in my region is also driven in part by conflict and the fragility around it. But we know that uncertainty is damaging on many levels, even if then the risks don't pan out. Yeah. So investments slow down, confidence slows down. So a lot can come from just an uncertain world.
Yeah. There's always someone in finance told me that risk is manageable, uncertainty isn't.
That's a good one.
I have so many of these. This is largely...
Oh boy, we need to hang out together.
We do. Maybe let's unpack the trade one for starting, okay. Because that's something Happily. Which I was... So at the IGC, we work with like 10, 11 countries across in Middle East and Africa and South Asia. And one of the biggest things people are concerned about is the trade infrastructure globally. And it feels a lot to policymakers that there was a set of norms around trade. There was an architecture which was built over the past several decades. And that seems to be coming down, or at least being reshaped quite drastically. And historically, we've often thought about and spoken about policymakers that the way you want to generate growth in your country is focus on exports or substitution of some imports. But you really want to build an engine tied to competitive advantage. You want to, you know, this whole, all the growth theory and development theory historically. Has that been changing? How should we think about trade and its connection with economic growth when a lot of the trade architecture is so uncertain, without naming names?
Okay, I promise. So let me start from drivers of change, and then hopefully we'll get to growth. So a big change that has happened in the past and has sort of sped up and accelerated in the past 30 years is technological change. And that has changed how stuff gets made and how we communicate. What's the link to trade? Think about the global value chains. And now... I don't know, my phone, which is not here for once on the table, is made by parts that are produced everywhere in the continent, and then the phone is assembled somewhere. So global value chains have become a way to make production more efficient, and that has shaped trade. What has also happened as of late is a revival of industrial policy, of sort of sector industry-specific policies, many of which have been motivated by national security concerns. And this has changed. You were talking about comparative advantage. This has really reshaped comparative advantage of countries. And then there is the story of the change in the order that seemed to be established.
Yeah.
Who's to say that it's not also a consequence of all these sort of decade-long trends? And now it has all come together in a massive increase in trade policy uncertainty. Let's call it that way. So it is true that if before countries or companies wanted to maximize efficiency, which means you produce in the place at the lowest cost, but then you end up producing in 15 different countries one good, right now they trade off that efficiency with, let's call it resilience, to be kind of like
generous,
because you need to kind of make sure that you're not that your product is not blocked, there's not a choke point somewhere. And so, you know, with resilience, probably you forgo a little bit of efficiency, your prices, your cost, and then prices and times might increase. So that's one part of the story. Just a minute ago, we were talking about just not trade policy, but we were just talking about uncertainty per se. And there's plenty of research that shows that just uncertainty increases prices, lowers investment, shifts choices of export or production. So there is that part that also plays out on the bigger scene. If I think about my region, so you said Middle East, so try to visualize it. Middle East, North Africa, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. So this is a beautiful, beautiful region.
The best region.
I didn't know it was a competition, but I love it. I absolutely love it. I love working on it. I love the people. I think the economic problems are incredible. And I think the potential of this region is immense. And I need to add, for realism, also often untapped.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to get back to that later. But let's go back to trade and my region. So if you think about this region, a lot of the trade is actually oil. Think about the Gulf, think about countries like Iran, think about countries like Libya or Algeria. At different tenors, at different levels, oils have been the bulk of their export. So trade policy uncertainty affects them to some extent, to the extent that it affects global demand. And we were saying, you know, we are in a global slowdown. So these countries are watching oil prices with attention, and many of them are actually trying to diversify away from oil with some of these industrial policies that we were talking about earlier. So that's a story that happens in my region, and there is a sort of maybe second round effect on oil. And then there are other countries who are more plugged in into trade. Actually, when we looked at the data, they are more plugged in than the average emerging and developing economy.
Okay. Overall,
but some of them produce trade in manufacturing, and some of these goods and some of these countries have been hit by more trade policy uncertainty and tariffs, either at the sectoral or at the country level. So what makes you more exposed and more vulnerable there? It depends what you export. And so what you export, how concentrated into one product you are, and how concentrated into one market you are. And most of these countries are not very exposed to overall risk related to trade. But if growth in the EU slows down, then there could be knock-on effects on imports from the Middle East and North Africa. If growth in China slows down, there will be knock-on effects not only on imports, but also on oil prices. So it's a moment of, for lack of a better word in my third language, reshuffling. And reshuffling is not always on the downside. Mm. It could also be on the upside. The question is, who's going to benefit from that upside? And usually, those countries that can benefit the most from a reshuffling of trade, a reshuffling of production, are the ones who are already trading a lot, who are already exporting, who are ready.
And have those firms and those
and have firms that can expand and so on. What is going to be reshuffled? I don't have the crystal ball. And if I did...
Oh, damn it. I thought that was the...
I didn't bring it today.
Christ.
I'm sorry. I don't have the crystal ball.
Okay, we're going to do second best then.
Second best. So second best is to look at profits and margins and where tariffs are the most likely to make a dent to life and death of a firm. And so the sectors where the profits are more squeezed are the ones where the tariffs can really make a difference. Think about textile or garments.
The margins are very, very
low. The margins are very low. Yeah. And so a tariff of 10, 15, 20% can really make a difference. And those are the sectors that have been the first to sort of look around and think where they can produce in a way that still makes them competitive. Yeah. So there's a lot of reshuffling, some of which could be opportunities for a region that on average trades more than the typical emerging and developing economy. But we did some math with a model called the gravity model. I think that Paul Krugman won the Nobel for that.
He did want a Nobel.
He won a Nobel.
That I'm sure about.
For that, but maybe also for something else.
I thought, was that TFP stuff, productive?
No,
that
TFP
was
around for a long, long time. For sure, I studied in the Solow model, which is from anywhere between 1949 and 1956, maybe 1956. Also, Solow won the Nobel
Prize.
That
is true. That for the growth model.
I think so.
Yeah, I presume so.
Okay, I think we can.
This is a very nerdy conversation. I'm really sorry for everyone who.
Sorry. Okay. We can go back to something like and not kind of
I wanna pull
nerdy.
Something pull something you were sort of reflecting on, and I'd be pivoting to a different direction. But if there is reshuffling, right? And a lot of things are gonna come down to what is the role of the state in all of this. Because you have firms and you might have really big firms or some big firms in this region. But a lot of the times, I have a very biased view because the only country in this region I've actually worked in Pakistan, is that firms are quite small. The state has a sort of an exaggerated role in how the market works, but also the state is taking a bigger role in elsewhere in the world where there are big markets anyways. And a lot of this comes down to industrial policy. And as you know, for the longest time, there was this sort of idea that this is a policy which shall not be named because it's sort of, there's so many risks here. This picking winners approach is not probably right. But think about IP more broadly, right? So the industrial policy And even on climate stuff, there's sort of this really good argument that you need sort of this green industrial policy to be able to build in externalities within sort of for firm behavior. How do you think about, from so based on your experience, on how do governments tend to approach industrial policy, especially in this kind of environment? I presume you have two different problems in this region, right? You have a problem which is like the Egypt-Pakistan problem, where you are a net importer of oil. Mm-hmm. So you're exposed to shocks there. That's your main BOP sort of eater, lack of better words. And you need to be able to build...
That was balance of payments.
Yes, balance of payments, sorry.
Just for two non-nerds who still follow us.
And you have this sort of... And the big policy challenge is that you need to create, you know, productive capacity in your economy, which creates jobs. So, and that's your big thing, right? That's the big problem. And then you have a other set of countries, basically Saudi Arabia where and UAE, Qatar, where the problem is not so much the lack of capital. You have a fair bit of capital. The problem is that you have a risk problem, that you're completely so dependent. Saudi, maybe it's slightly a different equation here, on a specific sector. And any shocks to that sector, especially long-term shocks with EVs and other stuff, is going to eat your ability to be able to function as a sort of a vibrant economy. So there's a sort of set of policy challenge there. In both dimension, I presume governments are looking at industrial policy to different ends, but very similar mechanisms, I presume state investments, incentives, all of this stuff. Do you have like a cheat sheet for governments? Like what when they approach industrial policy, what are the basic principles they should think about? Where do often failures happen? And where is it a good idea for states to be more proactive in the market and trying to, you know, manage this reshuffling in a bit more coherent manner?
Are you ready to be disappointed?
I'm 30 years old. It's been a disappointment for 3 decades.
Very good. Because I'm not going to talk about industrial policy first. Okay. When you asked me, what should governments do?
Yeah.
So first of all, you were very right in saying, well, this is all about the private sector firms reshuffling.
Yeah.
But what about the government? And the first thing that really comes to my mind as an economist is that the most important thing that countries can do, governments can do, is to improve the business environment. And this is not an industrial policy in the strict sense of favoring a sector vis-a-vis others, or providing incentives or subsidies or reduce costs to a sector. This is really make the business environment better, make your logistic better, reduce the number of days that it takes to import or export a good, reduce the complexity of regulation, make it more predictable and more certain. This is sounds like a boilerplate story, but when you talk to business people on the ground, they say the biggest, one of the biggest ordeals to me is really the time it takes to handle the complexity of regulation, the different layers of decision making to just get one good through the customs. So that would be my first layer answer. And if I were to build a cheat sheet, which excuse me, anyway, we need to be revised continuously. I will start from there. Then, I mean, you actually talked about something that I see happening a lot. And until a few years ago, nobody would talk about industrial policy. Yeah. It was definitely like a no-no.
And now there's so many conferences and everything.
And now it's like, it's almost all that we talk about is industrial policy. But so... Here, that's where like having studied a little bit of public economics helps. It's kind of like it's important to go back to economics 101. Where do you want investment, government intervention? Where there is something that looks like a market failure or a lack of coordination across sectors, some externality of sorts. And there are plenty of those in the productive world, and there is space for the government to intervene. Now, I love that nugget of like governments are not very good at picking winners, but losers are good at picking governments because the sort of image that we have of industrial policy is the government saying, I want to invest in that sector. I want to protect that sector. And some governments do exactly that. And somehow I've come to the realization that for governments that have been engaged in industrial policy, as like their flagship intervention, I cannot go and say, hey, you really need to improve the business environment. And they go like, thank you, but we really would like to know from you where we should invest our resources and time. And so instead of saying where, I think I'm better prepared to say how. And that's not what most governments do. So how is really identify where is the market failure. And this is for all the nerds who are following us. For the non-nerds, for all the other people, is where the private markets don't really deliver what a social planner would deliver for the benefit of everyone.
Yeah.
Once you've identified that market failure, if you decide to intervene as a government, you need to be very, very good at measuring what you do. Because the only way to avoid building, as we used to say, cathedrals in the desert, which is an expression that I'm translating straight from Italian. It doesn't come from my experience in the Middle East and North Africa. It comes from having read Italian literature about industrial policy in Italy in the post-war period. The way to avoid that is really to be able to measure what you do and being able to learn from mistakes. And I'd like to conclude the story on industrial policy in a way that will continue to disappoint you because I didn't tell you where, but so be it.
Yeah.
With the fact that one of the most frustrating things that I found in my region is that failure is not normalized. It's very difficult to admit that something did not work out. And since it is very difficult to admit it, measuring outcomes becomes difficult because it almost amounts to evaluating something. And if that evaluation were to find that something didn't work out, it's very difficult to accept it. And sadly, life, policy, the economy is full of stuff that doesn't work. And it's only from learning from what doesn't work that we can do something, put in place something that works. So
I think that's a really important point, partly because...
Are you disappointed?
No, I'm not. I am generally in life, but not exactly at this moment.
I didn't mean to be existential here.
We can talk about Camus in a second. But I think that's a really important point is because it is true that the use of data and evidence, I think, is a general point which can be linked to that. And I know the bank is in many ways also a knowledge bank, apart from the investments you make and the lending you do. But being able to identify what is working and what isn't working, that's sort of my job, but like that sort of seems to be like the key policy failure. But with industrial policy and a lot of other things, it's like once you set up, you know, you do intervene, you set up incentives or whatever in the market, you're also setting up political economy structures. And once you do it, it's incredibly painful and hard to remove these kinds of structures.
You make a good point, meaning in addition to a reluctance to measure, which I see in our systems, in our governments, a culture that is still emerging of measurement and evaluation. Then there are these sort of forces of political economy that are superimposed, that overlay this natural reluctance. And then it can become really, really difficult to sort of, you know, go have a sunset clause on that policy. But I think that with the conversation of industrial policy cannot be decoupled from a conversation about measurement. And these two things sound like, you know, apples and oranges, but they are not. They are really not.
Yeah. And there's a takeaway here for economists, academic economists too, on how there needs to be a lot more, perhaps, investment in building the measurement toolkit, which can be applied in real world settings.
Okay. Well, you know, you only manage what you measure.
That is true.
That's a good nugget.
Yeah. I was in Kigali and at the National Stats Office. It's called NICSER or something. And it was like, if you don't count, you don't count was their tagline. And I thought that was so cool. So I think there's this big thing that if you are going to be spending X amount of dollars or whatever the currency is, especially in a constrained environment where, you know, tax revenues might be constrained, aid sector, the countries in this region which have historically relied on aid, that has collapsed or nearly collapsed. We are going to a low aid world. And then maybe coming to one of the things maybe wanted your reflections on is on some of the debt side. That how this is something which is completely gibberish to me, by the way. I've been working in Zambia for a few years, and they went through default and restructuring and slight exposure to the Sri Lankan government when they had this sort of state. But it is a big thing, right? The cost of borrowing, it is getting higher than what I understand has been in the past. And that does put restrictions on the government, right? So on how much money they have to make these capital investments. And then probably makes role of the World Bank and other IFIs really, really important to provide that kind of capital and, you know, high externality investments.
So let me unpack a little bit what you were saying, because you said many different and important things. So the first one, debt. So the reality is that debt has increased across the board. And if I think about my region, it was increasing definitely before the pandemic. It had a blip up with the pandemic. And in some countries, and those are the oil importing countries, the ones that are most exposed to these shocks, it has reached significant and concerning levels. So that is absolutely true. I'll make a point about data transparency with debt as well.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, if people think about what do I need to do to get out of debt, people, let's say countries, my first reaction was always, well, you just need to grow out of it. Because, you know, you look at these indicators, it's debt over GDP. Like if you increase the denominator, again, this is for the nerds in the room, then, you know, this is going to shrink. It turns out that we've run that analysis, and in our region, my countries were unable to grow out of debt. As growth was happening in some countries, this very growth was financed with debt. So this was not the case across the board, but definitely in some cases, this was happening. So growing out of it was not necessarily even the solution. So a solution promote a private sector that can grow. And that's a conversation about enabling environment, industrial policy, a footprint of the state. You were talking about the state being a powerful force in Pakistan. But if we look at this region writ large, with just few exceptions, the state has a massive footprint. And it's not only just public employment that we're talking about. It's the sort of regulation, it's the operating through state-owned enterprises that compete not at the same level in a sort of neutral competitiveness with firms. So on one hand, it's like grow out of it, make sure that you shift the role of the state from being the protagonist in on the scene to being the scene director, let's say the orchestrator, but not the protagonist of the economy. Then, of course, exert appropriate fiscal restraint. But as you think about fiscal restraint, also use data and promote data transparency. So something that we learned when we were looking at debt, the evolution of debt in Egypt, was that a lot of that change in debt was due to sort of like statistical, something that goes into a residual, like statistical adjustment. And it was like,
that sounds
how can that be? This is a country which has an incredible capacity in terms of data.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how can that be all mistakes? And no, it turns out that those were increases in the debt that were coming from expenditure that were below the line. So they were not included in the sort of primary surplus or primary balance. So they were below the line expenditure, and then also revaluation of debt that was denominated in dollars or euro after the significant devaluation of the pound. So something like that transparency and data transparency can really help a policymaker to get a handle on the situation. And once you measure, then you manage it.
Yeah.
So it's a long conversation, which has parts of like private sector dynamism, role of the state, but also, again, use data well to measure and highlight where the problems are.
Yeah. I think one of the things I'm taking away is that you know, we have all these headwinds, and they're always, I presume, there's always something going on, right? There's always some kind of shocks and stresses to your system as an economy, whether they're endogenous or exogenous or whatever. And one of the learnings during COVID for me was also that countries which had the good foundations and sense of, you know, they had a state which was capable, had data, had evidence, had a good civil service, had robust public service infrastructure, had a private sector which was dynamic, had value chains which could be, you know, sort of restructured or onshored or whatever quickly, they were the countries which tended to do better on average. And that's probably like a lesson that even if you can't control everything happening around you, which you can't, you can probably control the things which are sort of the core foundations of a good economy, an effective state, good public services, good transport, good infrastructure, dynamic firms.
Very true. Very true. And that's a story that we continue to tell beyond the pandemic, because these pre-existing conditions, if we want to use a medical metaphor, are the ones that really can put countries on the brink. When a shock comes, and the shock need not be as dramatic as a pandemic, but it could be an increase in interest rates, or it could be a war. We were talking about fragility, and just think about what the increase in oil prices in 2022 did to countries. So you're right. I think it's really important to do prevention.
Yeah. One of the big stresses everywhere in the world, but a lot perhaps after sub-Saharan Africa or on par with that is in this region, is climate change.
Absolutely.
And Pakistan, I think this is a fairly big part of public discourse now. There were floods about a year or so ago, which, you know, a large amount of farmland was underwater, especially in the south. There have been floods recently over the past few weeks, months, not far from Lahore. And then before there were flash floods in the north, it seems like there's a recurring cycle of climatic disasters and shocks to the country. And then, of course, the other big thing is, which is sort of more slower in the news and public imagination, but is sort of just warming of average temperatures. And parts of the country get to close or exceed 50 degrees Celsius. Egypt will have similar problems, parts of the Middle East. And we talk about this in some ways. And I know you mentioned fragility too here. And that's, of course, very strong linkages between climate shocks and conflict and all of this stuff. This is a really big problem. And there's a problem here. There's sort of a bit of a collective action problem here too, because some of the action needed is global. And the cost is, of course, not evenly spread between every country in the world. What do you think about that? But also, what is like, what are the big ways you think this is going to impact countries and the economies and society? And what are the kind of actions globally and nationally the governments should be taking to make themselves better withstand this long-term stress?
I had to smile at the question because it was really not an easy one.
Yeah.
And I don't think we have all day. Let me just try to frame it for the countries that I know best. Clearly, it is a collective action problem, and it's a global one of a global nature with actors that face cost of different nature. So just think about the cost that you talked about, floods, droughts. Poor, low and middle income countries are the ones who bear the brunt of the vagaries of climate. If we just look at the Middle East and North Africa, this is also the region with the highest number of natural disasters that are connected to climate change.
Oh, is it?
With the highest cost in terms of GDP. I looked it up. Oh, so that's kind of really concerning. So what to do? First, I think we need to debunk the myth that either you grow or you do something that is good for climate change. It's not really a dichotomy. You can do adaptation policies that actually decrease the cost of all these events on people and on systems. And then you can try to grow in a way that is energy efficient and in a way that move towards a sustainable future. Yeah. I wanted to conclude this answer to a super difficult question with just one suggestion. A colleague of mine, Richard Damania, came up with a report, I think last year, where he basically said, hey guys, there is one low-hanging fruit. I hate that expression, but he was really right for climate change. It's like, get rid of fuel subsidies.
And so that's big in this region, right?
Let me just say that one. Okay, so you don't know what to do. If you really want a sort of playbook, start from getting rid of fuel subsidies.
And move the money to public transport investments, maybe.
Well, that's a longer conversation. Yes, but what you need to do is also to compensate the poor, who are the ones who would in theory actually need, not in theory, in practice actually need these subsidies, and compensate them with good social protection or good cash transfer measures. But as you get rid of fuel subsidies, you do also something that is quite clever, which is you take away the distortion to production towards capital and towards energy intensive production, and you free it up for labor. And guess what? In countries like Pakistan or Egypt, the abundance is people. And labor, is the one, and human capital is the one capital that poor people have. So you kind of also move the production towards something that can really deliver jobs for economies that really need them.
Perfect. That sounds great. I have a final, very quick question, and then we're going to conclude.
Is it an easy one or a difficult one?
It's a very personal one in a sense. Okay. Like you work on this sort of fairly vast region. And in a very important position, the bank is, you know, a really consequential player here. What is like one thing you're doing, or your office or your team is doing, which you're super excited about? Is it, if it could be a project, it could be a report, it could be anything, it could be fancy like AI, it could be really brick and mortar like education programs or something.
Can I say two things?
Let me consider. Oh, sure.
Okay. All right. So the first one is to highlight the benefits of increase female labor force participation.
Okay.
And these are benefits that really could make ministers of finance go like, what?
Yeah.
So we calculated that if you bring the employment rate of women at the same level as men's in Egypt, you could increase GDP by 51%.
Wow.
That's a lot. That's a large number. So when you become minister of finance, remember this number.
Me, personally.
You personally.
Egypt might be a bit of a stretch, but we can speak to the government.
I think that also in Pakistan, we could come up with, and not make them up, but really, you know, calculate them from something as basic as a solo model.
Yeah.
And sort of think through where it would go to if you increase female labor force participation. And the second one is governance. And the angle that I'm working on is the one of data transparency and data openness, which I think is a corner of that world. But we live in a region that has a governance deficit, and improving data openness and data transparency can empower scholars, people, and overall improve the relationship between citizens and governments.
Perfect. This is a great way of concluding, Roberta. And again, welcome to Pakistan.
Thank you.
I hope you have a great time in Lahore.